You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Bran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Greetings, folks. It's the fifth Sunday after Pentecost, and we'll be looking at 2 Samuel 1, verse 1 and 17 to 27, Psalm 130, and particular focus on 2 Corinthians 8, 7 to 15, and Mark 5, 21 to 43.
Thanks, Fran. And joining us today, we're really excited to have our friend and colleague, the Reverend Dr. Gary Warete Deverell here. Gary is a Trelulwe man from northern Tasmania, an Anglican priest, and currently works as the Vice Chancellor's Fellow in Indigenous Theologies at the University of Divinity. He's written lots of books and articles, but one of the most recent book, and one we're going to talk about a little later, is called Gondwana Theology, A Trelulwe Man Reflects on Christian Faith. So welcome, Gary, and thanks for being here.
Delighted to be here, folks.
Yeah, thanks.
So we're going to get right in with the 2 Corinthians chapter 8 reading. Fran, what's going on here?
Well, apparently there is some controversy now. What I was going to say was this letter was written after the first letter when the Corinthians had rejected Paul and, all that he was saying. And he told them off through Titus, and then they'd said, oh, yes, he is on the ball. We do endorse Paul. And so this letter is him writing to them in a softer tone perhaps than the first letter. About their capacities and appealing to them in this part in particular to raise money for the poor in Jerusalem.
Mm. And, I mean, basically, to cut a long academic story short, generally scholars admit that 2 Corinthians is a mess, mm-hmm. and it's possibly three letters. Some people think it's five letters, depending who you read. Not really important for preaching, except to say there's complexity here and there was perhaps a more dynamic correspondence back and forth of multiple letters, not just two, which speaks to the relationship. And Gary, what did you notice in this reading? And, I don't know if you want to launch in there or whether there's even a prior question of kind of how do you approach a reading like this when you think about preaching it? And particularly with the kind of your own complex lenses as Anglican priest, scholar, and Indigenous Australian. Talk to us about how you approach such a scripture and then what you noticed in this particular one.
Well, I think mostly when I read scripture, Robin, it's obviously not as a biblical scholar because my skills in this area are fairly challenged. But I do read it with, a fair bit of literary nous, and I read it, obviously, like everyone else does, noticing things that are perhaps closer to resonances in my own experience and my own story. Now, that can be a disadvantage, of course, because there's always the problem where you might project your own experience onto the text and miss a whole bunch of things that are actually really important that are there. But on the other hand, one could argue, and I often do, that that one's own personal story can make connections with the text, which perhaps others don't necessarily pick up on because they have a different experience. So in my case, I suppose, looking at this this chapter 8, the thing that leaps out at me is the theology of generosity, which begins Christologically. So Paul argues that, the Lord Jesus Christ, though he was rich, became poor so that you might be enriched. And out of that Christological kind of perspective, he then makes an argument for a generosity from the Corinthians in imitation of those he's praised in Macedonia in order to meet the needs of the folk in Jerusalem. And interestingly, there's a bit of Marxism here if you're interested in sort of reading these things through a Marxist lens. The argument is that the one who had much did not have too much and the one who had little did not have too little, the idea being that We're not wanting everyone to drive themselves into poverty in order to meet the needs of others. We're just wanting, if you're able to contribute to someone else out of your surplus, then you might want to do that because there's a bit of karma in this and it might come back your way at some point in the future as well. So it's an argument for equality.
Yes.
So that those who have a surplus can contribute to those who are struggling a bit. So, you know, I find that interesting, and probably that comes out of my own experience as a child where we lived in, you know, poverty insofar as poverty exists in this country. You know, neither of my parents were able to work. We were dependent upon welfare as I was growing up. And I noticed these kinds of things in scripture probably out of that experience.
Yeah. And that even if basic needs are met, there's something about the generosity and the freedom and some of the life choices that a little bit of excess gets you every now and again that's very different and life-giving. I wonder if this is a much more palatable ethical teaching for many sitting in our churches than something that can come across as a bit more radical as the Acts share everything, or the costly discipleship of Mark of basically give up your life.
Yeah, that struck me. This is a lot more moderate than that, and also it's not being commanded, whereas elsewhere, you know, Paul commands us to love, for example. Here it seems to be a lot softer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which might have something to do with the tone of the letter that I was talking about earlier.
Mm. I wanted to pick up on, you mentioned this theology of generosity, which is a lovely phrase, and I think the word generous might actually track better with us as modern hearers than grace. But one of the things to notice in this text is actually in Greek there's this repeated word of charis, grace, all the way through these a few chapters here of 2 Corinthians, but the NRSV doesn't always translate it as grace. So, it, you know, it starts off with
privilege.
I think the NRSV uses the word generous, the generous act of Jesus Christ, which is the grace in the Greek. So there's a play on grace, I think we think of it as some spiritual thing to do with forgiveness, but that grace is about divine generosity. It takes us back to that.
I think it's quite material here as well.
And, practical in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think grace has been over-associated with forgiveness, with the putting away of debts in that sort of moral sense. But here clearly grace has to do with generosity, with giving, with actually the sort of nurturing of others who are perhaps not in the same position when it comes to socioeconomic matters.
Yep.
So quite a different sort of understanding of grace than some of the, particularly the sort of devotional books that are around about amazing grace.
Yeah, which also can then reduce it too easily to an individual spiritual experience as well without any.
Indeed,
Yep.
Yep.
I want to make a connection, if it's not too soon.
Yep.
between verse 9 here, about Jesus became poor for our sake and what's happening in the Mark reading when the hemorrhaging woman touches his cloak and his flow of power comes out of him into her.
Yes.
And there's sort of this he becoming weak in that sense of giving up his power to her.
Yeah, for me that's one of the connections between the two New Testament readings, and we can move into Mark if we're all ready to do that. It's a huge, rich reading and we won't get to cover everything. But right in that central story of the hemorrhaging woman where she touches Jesus' robe, there's a play on the flow. So she has a flow of blood and he has this flow of power that goes out of him. And I'm drawing here on an article that a scholar called Candida Moss wrote, and I'll put a link in. There's also a fantastic podcast, the New Testament Review podcast, did a whole podcast on that article unpacking the arguments. So for those who can't access the academic article, I'll put a link in. You might just want to listen to their explanation and walking you through it. But she makes the argument that Jesus in that scene, his body parallels the woman's body So in antiquity, male bodies are supposed to be hard and controlled and firm, and female bodies are wet and porous and weak. And this tracks on to sort of really unhelpful but just normative gender kind of constructions. And so when Jesus has this flow of power go out of him that he apparently has no control over, he, you know, asks who touched me, his body is mimicking and taking on the characteristics of the woman's body. And in doing so, she is healed and dried up. And the language there is literally language of drying up something that's wet. And so her body takes on some of Jesus' characteristics. And to me, there is a link here to this 2 Corinthians of something about the vulnerability that Jesus models of taking on, literally embodying the characteristics of those whose needs he's trying to meet, with the poverty. Yeah. With I don't know what we do with that. Gary, what did you notice, or what would you want to comment on in the Mark 5 reading?
Well, I guess those of us who function a bit better in the sort of systematic or philosophical theology sort of space than we do in biblical, where this passage takes us, I think, too, is this idea of an exchange that occurs in covenant, I suppose, or in the performance of a covenant between God and human beings, or even God and the earth. So there's this sense in which God, who is traditionally the locus of power, the locus of all good things, some of that flows out of God in order to make room for ourselves and to empower ourselves as either creatures or as, I would argue, in Indigenous context, also the earth itself. And so in that sense, it's really easy to interpret human things as divine things, as signs of the divine. So a hemorrhaging woman can teach us about the generosity of God. The rivers that flow through the sea and come to the shore can teach us about the generosity of God in sort of making the earth fruitful, you know, those sorts of things. So there's an exchange not only of symbols here, but I would argue also of divine life, or whatever life is. The breath of God, the life of God is shared. It's not something that's single in itself in the Godhead, and we get access to by virtue of our many prayers or something like that. God is actually generously sharing with us all the time whatever God has to share. And the problem is not so much that we that it's not available, that this plentiful, bountiful, excessive life is not available to us. The problem is that we don't even reach out to touch it or to speak it like this woman does. And so this woman is an ideal disciple in the gospel because she reaches out for that which is freely given, and she is healed, she is blessed.
Yeah. We either don't reach out or we don't realize. I'm sort of popping back to the Corinthians reading here, because they excel in everything, in faith, in speech and in knowledge and so on. There's sort of a taking for granted that you are blessed in this way if you don't respond to the call to give back.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's both courage and vulnerability in reaching out too, right? That's, you have to know you have a need. You have to recognize what's perhaps lacking. And when you have all those other things, you don't always recognize what's lacking in your own life, or we fill the holes with all the other stuff that a capitalist world has told us will fill the holes in our lives.
Distracting ourselves to death, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. TV is the opium of the masses today. We should say there's lots of other pairings in the Mark reading. So the classic one I think most people know about is that, you know, this is a Mark and sandwich. So we start with the story of a synagogue leader's daughter, Jairus' daughter, who's also 12, so that the 12 links the women. We've got a 12-year-old girl who's dying and a woman who's been bleeding for 12 years, so 12 years of experiencing a certain kind of social death. And, you know, so there's parallels there too between whose needs Jesus meets, and I think the juxtaposition of the daughter of a powerful man, you know, relatively within his own social circles, who's got a man of some means to advocate for her. And then this woman who appears to be alone and does not have anyone to advocate for her. So we've also got some pairing and power dynamics there in the way these two women are set up alongside each other, but both who desperately need Jesus.
And both who come, although they are so unalike in those social ways, both come to faith.
Yes. Yep. And celebrate faith. What would you preach on this Sunday if you were preaching? You might be preaching, Gary.
Yeah. Where do you normally preach these days, Gary?
Just wherever anyone is desperate for a preacher.
I don't think that's true.
Anyone who's really desperate or falls sick at the last minute, so, I tend to go there.
There, you've heard it, folks. There, you've heard it. We'll put his email in the show notes.
People tend not to book me in years ahead, you know. They just give me a call on the Sunday morning and say, Gary, I'm really sick. Can you come and fill in?
Come and say
something.
I'd
like to make it clear we issued you an invitation some time ago.
That's right. We got in early.
This is the last minute, folks.
Yeah.
Yep.
But what preaching themes emerge for either of you from this before we move on to lament, which I want to get to in a sec too?
Look, just that there's a kind of classic gospel paradox here about weakness being strength. So it's by becoming weak and womanly in the terms that you used earlier, Robin, that Jesus is actually able to strengthen and buttress the lives of these two people, one a young girl and one an older woman. So it seems to me that there's something in here about strength through weakness, or accomplishment through vulnerability.
Yep,
and that ties in with really what's happening with Jesus is instructing a leader in the synagogue to learn about faith from someone who's an outcast. And I wondered, and this might be a bit of a stark analogy, Gary, so you can correct me, but I did wonder about our First and Second Peoples situation in Australia, that in fact we as Second Peoples need to learn from First Peoples in the same dynamic that's happening in this passage between Jairus and the outcast woman.
Yeah, well, there is a sense, is there not, in which, by virtue of colonisation and everything that flows on from that, that First Peoples are hemorrhaging continue to hemorrhage. Mm. In some places, our children are dead because of, suicide or deaths in custody spiritually dead because we... Part of what colonisation does is takes us away from the spiritual resources which sustain us, separates from those from us, whether it be country or elders or all kinds of other wisdom. And so, these are exactly the experiences of marginalised peoples everywhere, including Indigenous folk in this country. And if the issues seem too big, I often just say to people, well, look, even within the church, Indigenous leaders don't get paid to do their pastoral work in our churches. Mm. I mean, I keep being horrified by the fact that I can talk to an Indigenous leader who's working 24 hours a day trying to look after the needs of their community precisely as a pastoral minister. And yet our churches don't do any sort of generous redistribution of funds in order to make sure that those people get paid. Mm-hmm. So that in itself is an issue to be addressed, I would have thought.
Yeah.
And is the call in the Second Corinthians.
Yeah, that's obviously right. Takes us back there too. I want to circle back to something you said before, Gary, too, about learning learning from the land, and this is something we can hear in Indigenous wisdom and tradition. There's an article I found quite challenging by a Botswanan feminist scholar, Musa Dube, called 50 Years of Bleeding, and she does a reading of this Mark passage playing on the hemorrhaging woman, but the woman becomes Mama Africa. And she talks about all the money and resources that are spent patching up, you know, that came through the trade and colonization and all these other things, but Mama Africa is still bleeding. And it seems to me it's a similar sensibility in taking us to, you know, it's an ancient thing to give the land a female persona, but the land is bleeding, and until the acknowledgement of what's caused the land to bleed is addressed, she'll keep bleeding.
So I'll put that up too.
It could be a helpful way for preachers to think, this is in many ways one of those well-known biblical passages. So it could be a helpful way for people to think of what might be a creative or a different way to preach it.
Well, that's definitely a voice outside all of it, most of our experience.
Yeah.
You know, tying into what Gary was saying before about approach to scripture, that it's not something I would come up with out of my experience.
No. Yeah, and it ties back to that point you made, Fran, about that, you know, Jairus is the synagogue leader and he gets called the leader several times. Mm. You know, his status is clear, and yet he needs to learn something really basic about faith.
So-called outcast.
Yeah. Yep.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find a link at our website, fatherwell.com.au.
So, Gary, I wanted to ask you maybe a more general question about lament, but for those who want to preach this week on either Psalm 130 or 2 Samuel 1, both of those Old Testament passages are effectively laments. In 2 Samuel, David does this song of lament upon hearing that King Saul and his son Jonathan are dead. And then the psalm is also a classic psalm of lament. And I think a lot of Christians don't know quite what to do with lament. And I know that you're both a liturgist and a theologian, amongst many other things. I wanted to ask you, what is the role of lament in liturgy and how might we talk about it helpfully? And I say this, I guess, if I own my own experience, the Uniting Church went through a bit of a phase a while ago where it felt like we were lamenting everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt like a joyless Christianity. So how do we lament in ways that move us forward rather than just become depressing forms of Christianity is really my most unnuanced question for you.
Yeah. Well, that's not an easy question, Robin. I think if lament is done by the privileged, and it's a lament primarily about the ways in which the privileged have failed others, then it's actually a fairly narcissistic kind of lament, and you can get stuck inside a little echo chamber and it can be fairly miserable. Whereas I think that if you quite literally try to lament out of a conversation with people who are genuinely struggling in life in all kinds of different ways. And, you know, the theories of intersectionality are really about how different levels of experience all come together and make life fairly traumatic for many folk. If you lament out of and with people like that, then lament can actually be very therapeutic for everyone. Because there's a kind of a solidarity that emerges out of that, and somehow out of the conversation about the realities of the lives we experience, we find strength in each other. Mm-hmm. We find strength in each other, and there's a kind of mutual giving and a mutual generosity, which enables the lament to go somewhere, as it were, to take the eyes off the sort of low horizon where the pain is, and lift up towards a horizon. And I know many of those psalms of lament sort of end with a sort of lifting of the eyes, as it were, a symbolic lifting of the eyes towards new possibilities, new horizons, new dreams kind of thing. So I would distinguish between kind of narcissistic self-flagellation and actually a lament that comes out of a genuine experience of conversation and listening and understanding with folk who perhaps don't share the privileges we share, and a generation of lament out of that experience with each other out of that. I think in my experience, there's a vast difference between those two things.
That's really an invitation, isn't it, or maybe a command, an imperative for quite privileged communities to break out of their echo chamber, isn't it? Because it can't, like, you can write a lament that lifts in hope, but it's not the same as a lament you might participate in that's genuinely out of a conversation with those who are
or a shared grief. I mean, one of the things that strikes me in the Samuel passage is we know from other texts that that David loved Jonathan. The Bible tells us he loved Jonathan's love was greater than the love of any woman, which has spawned its own reflection. You know, it goes to what you're saying, Gary, that you know, it's out of a genuine moment of grief and an experience. And if we're lamenting for the sake of saying words to make ourselves feel better or something, it's not actually that same. That dynamic is missing.
Yeah, and I mean, very clearly the lament in Samuel comes out of, again, this experience of covenant. I've mentioned this word a few times already today. David and Jonathan had a covenant, and it was one of those complex covenants that was both very, very personal, but also in a sense it held the nation together, because the covenant between Jonathan and David actually made it possible for David to coexist with Saul for a very, very long time.
Yes.
And held things together so that the frontier was pushed back, which made room for what happened afterwards with the Davidic kingdom. But it does seem to me that in covenant, what you're always doing is you're negotiating relationships, you're negotiating difference, you're finding things that are in common, but you're also experiencing the difference in the other person or the other community, and learning to appreciate those things. So lament comes out of this complex performance, I would say, of covenant, which is a sort of dance of differences, and a listening to those differences and a making room for the diversity of that experience within one's own heart and one's own sort of more familiar community. So it expands the sense of family and what the familial actually means, so that it's a broader, larger, more complex and more deeply interfused community.
Yeah.
It's quite a personal loss that's lamented here, in a way that you don't find in much of the rest of Scripture too, this passage.
Yeah, in the David and Jonathan and Saul relationships. But, I mean, I think if you read the Psalms, it is that, like, the, you know, the Psalm 130, out of the depths I cry to you. I mean, depths is,
yeah, it could be
metaphorical language, but it speaks to experiences of facing one's own mortality, of utter despair. I mean, those are.
But this is personal loss I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Of a friend.
But those are also deeply personal. I mean, you despair because of something that's happened to you that's profoundly, yeah. But yes, it's relational. And I do love that emphasis you've just directed us to, Gary, on covenant, because that is everywhere, obviously, in these texts. And that, you know, even the covenant with Yahweh and the people has those same elements of political and personal, always. Yep.
Yeah.
Look, we're almost at our traditional time, but for those of you who want to keep listening, we're going to make Gary stick around for another few minutes and bombard him with a few more questions. And one of the reasons to do that is that in Australia, at least, July, which is coming up, is Black History Month. And it's, you know, different communities celebrate this differently, and it has some, you know, variations on. I know in America there's also a Black History Month that has its own tradition. But it's a month that was chosen to sort of enhance celebrations like NAIDOC Week, but particularly to celebrate rich Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island history. And one of the things I loved about your book, Gary, the Gondwana Theology book, which I highly recommend to everyone and we'll put a link to, is that the last third or so is actually a rite. It's a liturgy. So I wanted to ask you what prompted you? What desire in you as an Anglican, or what's not in the traditional, without, you know, don't mean to pick on Anglicans, but what's not in the traditional Anglican liturgy that sparked your desire to write this that you say draws on the Australian landscape and the experience of First Nations people with God? And I guess the follow-up question is, if there are, you know, Australians listening who might want to do something liturgically in July, apart from using your liturgy, which is excellent, you know, what else can we be doing in our churches if we wanted to, you know, be a bit more mindful during Black History Month of the ways we can listen and celebrate and elevate the voices of our Indigenous sisters and brothers? So, but firstly, what prompted you? What sparked this liturgical creativity?
Well, it didn't all come in a burst, Robin.
Wasn't a divine revelation on one Monday afternoon?
No, it was more like a progressive revelation over many years, I suppose. it seems to me that it's really important in a country like Australia, which has this very complex history, not least with the church's engagement with Indigenous peoples, that the prayers that we offer to God, with God as the primary audience, if you like, should represent the complexity of this conversation. Partly that's a conviction around the gospel being primarily about truth.
Yeah.
But it's also, it comes out of a conviction that the gospel is primarily about love. And love is not a feeling primarily, in my humble opinion.
Yep, I agree.
Love is primarily a set of behaviours or practices which honour the other person or honour the other community or whatever it is, that honour God in the way that God honours us. So there's a sense, I think, in which I think our prayers ought to embody both truth but also love, which is conversational, which is relational, which encodes, as it were, the relationships that we have with each other and the ways in which those relationships are often broken and need repair. But we can dream about how the relationship could be better. And we can dream about how to get there by telling the truth as much as we can about ourselves, first of all, taking the little speck out of our own eyes in order to tell the truth about others, taking the log out of other people's eyes. You know, so you know, that kind of stuff. To me, liturgy is primarily about encoding those relationships, and prayers encoding those relationships. Now, I could say a hell of a lot more complex stuff about the different moments in the liturgy and that kind of stuff. But at essence, I think liturgy is about this performance of the covenant between God and ourselves, between God and the earth, ourselves and the earth, with each other in our brokenness. And it simply encodes that and makes it explicit so that we can see what, you know, we can see clearly, or at least to some extent, what's actually going on in our hearts and our lives and our relationships, so that it can be reflected back at us and we can perhaps adjust our behaviour in some way towards a more redemptive way of doing things.
Thank you. And one of the things I really like about this liturgy is that I think from what, you know, from my limited understanding, admittedly, of Indigenous spirituality, you know, that emphasis on the land, and you talk in your book about the land is its own sacred text in this tradition. And that to me comes through really strongly in a way that I think may well resonate, you know, somewhat surprisingly, really, but we're at a moment, you know, in the global community of recognizing that we can no longer ignore the environment and the world we live in and our relationship with it as humans. And, of course, that ancient wisdom is already there. We've just ignored it for a really, really long time. But I love how that comes through in your liturgy here.
I'm wondering, and it might be a sort of personal question. So I'm wondering, out of the process of writing, I don't know, whether you felt a sense of a shift in yourself in the process of writing. I don't know from where to where. I'm just interested in the process of it's super helpful book and quite profound. So I just wondered if you could talk to that at all.
Well, look, it's no secret, and many friends who may be listening to this will know this story, but it's no secret that I didn't really want to write any of this stuff down. I just didn't feel there was an audience for it. And, you know, if you read my first book, which was my PhD, you know, it's a very different kind of writing, different kind of text.
I'd like to say I tried to read your first book. And it was a bit too clever for me, Gary.
Yeah, well, it was a bit too clever for me too, Rob. I think early on, when I was attempting to articulate theological matters, I did so very much out of a sense that this is the kind of thing that was expected in the church. And I guess I've come to realise that the church is pretty colonial in what it expects of people. Mm-hmm. And I guess I realised that there wasn't a lot that was terribly life-giving in that for me, and that really what I should do was return to the first text that I experienced when I was a child, which is the text of the land and country. And so over a number of years, I guess I did that. I returned to that first text and I held it next to the other text that is obviously very important for me as a Christian, which is the Bible.
Mm.
And I did a lot of comparing and contrasting, and I started to read the second text, as it were, the biblical text for images of the divine, which were largely analogies that come out of the natural world. And I began to see that if you exegete the second text as also in many ways a text that emerges from landscape and the experience of country, then you can actually find a common voice there. You can find a common voice. The divine speaks. So these days I just say to people, look, the divine speaks in at least two ways. One is through country and one is through you know, biblical or sacred texts. And the task is not to create doctrinal formulations which say, you know, which is the most important or which mode is the most important, or, you know, creating endless hierarchies of how you interpret this in the light of that, but simply to listen to it all and to be healed.
Yep.
You know, to listen and be healed. These days I spend at least as much time listening to country as I do reading the biblical text. I'm still your sort of classic, your classic Western Christian, in the sense that, you know, I get up in the morning and I say my daily prayer and I read my biblical text and that kind of stuff. But I also spend, at least an hour each day trying to go somewhere where I can actually get my face wet if it's raining, or I can smell the smells of the wildflowers as the rain falls on them. You can see I was brought up in Tasmania.
The rain.
There's constant references to rain. But, you know.
Cold and rainy, if people don't know anything about Tasmania.
That's right. And you know, these days I have a fascination, an absolute fascination with just watching creatures, you know, watching animals. And, you know, I've learned all the sort of traditional names for them in the country that I come from in northeast Tasmania. I'm a bit behind the eight ball elsewhere. But just fascinated watching them and seeing how they know how to live. They just get on with it and are unconcerned in that way that in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about the lilies of the field and the birds of the air, you know. They don't store up wealth for themselves. They just kind of get on with it because they know that God will provide for them. Well, there's something to be learned from that kind of creaturely existence, I think. So listening to country is not magic. It's just paying attention and learning the wisdom that is already there and trying to perhaps live a little bit that way yourself amidst the complexities of, you know, surveillance capitalism or whatever you call what we're doing now. So, it's tricky.
Yeah.
But I think there's a great deal to be learned by doing so.
Well, I hope you found that there has been a significant audience for your book, Gary.
Yeah.
Keep writing.
We need more of this, those of us who
even if it's not rocket science to you, like, you know, might be to the rest of us.
Folk, you're listening to the voice of Gary Deverell, the Vice Chancellor's Fellow in Indigenous Theologies at the University of Divinity. Gary's going to be back on next week's podcast, and we're very grateful for you giving us time for a couple of episodes. Before we let you go today, with Black History Month coming up, and I ask this with some hesitation because I'm conscious that those of us who are white and Western, which is me, can well-meaningly latch on to certain things and do something for a period and feel like we've ticked our kind of responsible citizen box. But, you know, so it's not about doing something for a month. It's ultimately about doing something that might change hearts and minds and practices more broadly. But are there do's and don'ts for churches who might, that, you know, you would want to say to the wider church? And I know you've spent time, your roots are in the Baptist church, you've spent time in the Uniting Church, you know the Australian church landscape pretty well. What are your do's and don'ts for communities and ministers wanting to kind of be better at this listening that you're describing and the engaging with our Indigenous fellow Australians?
Well, for me, a don't is... Don't invite Indigenous people along to do stuff during NAIDOC Week or Reconciliation Week.
Okay.
Just don't do it, because what we end up doing is getting really worn out and quite depressed.
Yep.
during those particular weeks.
Invite you another time.
Yeah, invite us another time.
Yeah.
It's just that. If there's no conversation happening the rest of the year, and then you get 15 invitations during NAIDOC Week or Reconciliation Week or Black History Month, which I didn't even know about until I talked to you earlier, Robin.
There you go.
I think that that's a no-no, just a practical no-no.
Yep.
So what I would encourage churches to do is to invite people to talk along. To talk about stuff at other times of the year and spread it out a bit. That's just a duty of care thing, I think.
Yep.
And the other thing is I think when there's less pressure around particular, you know, celebrations and events, there's actually more leisure to unpack things and talk in a more, in a less urgent kind of way. And I think if there's anything we need these days, it's less urgent spaces for conversation. So, you know, that may be a bit counterintuitive for some of the listeners, but it just seems to me that that in the same way that Christmas and Easter can kill your average clergy person for weeks afterwards.
Yep.
You know, there's something to be argued for thinking about Easter and Christmas for the rest of the year and putting less pressure on at those times, similarly when it comes to engaging with Indigenous people.
Mm. Well, thank you for being so generous with your time with us today, and we look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Thank you, Gary.
Thanks for joining us.
No worries. Happy to be.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.